Picture this, two guys trapped in the South Charleston Public Library. One guy loves movies, the other, well, he'd rather be watching reality TV. Can they survive each other's films? Find out on Real Opposites, a library podcast about movies, hosted by Josh and Aaron from the South Charleston Public Library.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to The Real Opposites. I'm Aaron.
I'm Josh.
And we're back for our special episode with our special guest, Kendall.
Hi, everyone.
And this episode is our Shakespeare episode. Kendall chose Merchant of Venice and Much Ado About Nothing. And I guess we'll just jump into your first movie if you want to tell us what it is and why you chose it.
Sure thing. First movie is Much Ado About Nothing from 1993. And I chose this movie because it's a pretty traditional Shakespeare comedy. Mm-hmm. Fairly lighthearted. No one really dies. We end with some happy married couples with a lot of conflict in between. Yes. But I feel like this movie is beautifully filmed, beautifully acted by an all-star cast, including a very young Kate Beckinsale.
Her first movie.
Oh, wow.
A very dapper Denzel Washington.
Very dapper. That man is handsome.
Yes.
Keanu Reeves is our villain, Emma Thompson, and Kenneth Branagh, who also directed as Beatrix and Benedict. Okay. So
weird to see Keanu as a villain. Just whenever he's a villain, things he does a good job, but it's like, oh.
Yes.
You're so sweet.
He's such an inherently nice guy. Kind of weird.
He does a good job.
He really does.
He does a great job. Bastard brother of the prince. But yeah, I'm curious what you all thought of this Elizabethan rom-com.
So I'm curious, like, when did you first see it? When it came out? Or, like, what is it about Much Ado About Nothing that among Shakespeare's works and film adaptations that you like?
Honestly, I feel like the cast is very strong. And I felt it was a runtime that was more accessible.
It's like the 4.5 hour Hamlet.
Accessible. Yeah. Some of the tragedies run long. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure about the viewability of them if you're not super committed to the Shakespeare cause. Whereas I feel like, I think Much Ado is a pretty easy, like, kind of like introduction if you're not really into Shakespeare to...
It is.
Get into it. I feel like there really isn't. I don't feel like it's hard to kind of get over that language barrier with that movie. It's very well adapted.
It's pretty breezy.
Yeah. There's a lot of, like, you know, witty repartee, but I think it's still pretty easy for us to follow as 2020s people versus 1590s people.
Right.
I think it's fun to see a lot of these actors and actresses so young and fresh. And it's just beautiful, light, kind of easy.
Yeah.
Easy meal.
When I started watching, I was watching at home, and sometimes I have an issue, as we know, getting into movies. And
You don't say.
No.
Never heard that one before.
Never.
So I put the movie on, and I got my little Dominard out, and I was doing that to try to calm my ADHD. But I think I was in one of those moods where it was hard to connect to a movie anyways. And with it being Shakespearean language, it made it a little difficult for me at first. But I finished the movie here. I'm at work while I was working on some stuff. And I don't know if it was just I was better focused or where I had a headphone like in my ear and it was right there playing. It was super easy to like listen to and watch, and the language wasn't an issue at all. So I guess I would say it was my issue on the first part. But yeah, you do. I mean, they definitely talk Shakespearean, but it does flow really well. And even when I was having trouble paying attention, I still laughed a couple times. I mean, like it's a funny movie.
It's very funny. I mean,
it's
there's
very
great...
cheeky.
Yeah.
And it is, I would say, It's an easy watch.
It flew by. Yeah. We watched it last night, and I think it's an hour and 50 minutes, but I felt like it was over.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't...
It just flows well.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
really
not...
Well
nothing's drug out.
No, and it just... it's always moving. There's always some scheming or conniving going on within the characters that's keeping the thing, keeping the film flowing.
Right.
I think there's some great, I guess the word is like situational comedy, like especially that whole scene with Kenneth Branagh where he's kind of listening in and he explains and then he has to make it sound like a bird. And you can really see how this would have worked well and does work well on stage, he's but like, also is very easily adaptable.
He's so offended. Yeah. He's like, oh, and then like, and you're like that.
I mean, it's still pretty funny.
Yeah,
it is.
Oh, I found it. Yeah. I found it to be really funny.
Yeah. To Beatrice,
I did like that.
Like they're like so... head to heads are so fun. Where they're just like, even at their wedding, they're like, I'll marry you to because I pity you, or what? And like, you know, they have this like back and forth, and everyone's like, shut up. Like, you love each other. Get over yourselves. It's great.
So, yeah, an interesting fact that Emma Thompson and Kenneth Branagh were married when this movie was filmed and when it came out. So I think their chemistry and their kind of, you know, their back and forth repartee is...
Yeah, it shows through.
It's very genuine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that they definitely have, like, the best chemistry of any of the two people in the film. Mm-hmm. Like, they really...
Yeah.
They really shine. Those are my favorite parts. Their scenes together.
I will say, I think the jilted at the altar scene, it's still kind of like, it's sad and hard to watch. Like, you feel really bad.
Like when he thinks she cheated.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah.
The way he treats her and she's like, yeah, I was watching that and I was like, oh. Her dad's like, I'm going to kill you. I mean, some of this is a little bit, you know, antiquated for our standards.
Right, exactly. But I mean, that's how it was then.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean.
Well, just it, like her life is ruined in that moment. Then, like that is you have no prospects of anything. Ever, like you probably are never going to get married.
Yeah,
you've like and
well,
like,
and it sounds
really,
like they kill them
and,
as well.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Like sometimes a parent who's shamed would kill their child. Yeah. So it's like that was a big deal, and it's really they really drive that home with like how big and explosive that scene is, and him knocking over all the pews and like and
it's a
little
big scene.
Little Claudio does a great job there, Robert Sean Leonard.
Yeah. So I mean, there's some not nearly as heavy as the next play. We'll talk about Merchant of Venice, but there's some kind of heart-wrenching
drama.
Yeah, heart-wrenching moments for some of the characters.
Yeah.
Well, you really feel for her. She's just kind of the sweet
kid,
and she's just been completely humiliated and
for
and
very I think little reason. Like,
yeah, has no idea why. Yeah. He just is there to cause trouble.
Like, I think just, that's why part of Megan. The... I think that's why that part also feels intense, because they do a good job of making you feel bad for her because of how innocent she is, and she really knows nothing what they're talking about. And I think that really pulls you in, and that's why that scene is also a little hard to watch.
Like, I like how a lot of the drama is set up in that one moment where the soldiers ride in to the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they have a little moment, if I remember, where Don Juan... Is it Don Juan?
Don John.
Sorry. I'm trying to keep up with the names. He will be Keanu Reeves from henceforth.
Keanu Reeves.
The bastard Prince Brian.
Yeah. Like, I think he has like a moment where he's like, because he's a little jealous that Hero's getting attention from, like, he's got like a little crush on her.
No, he's jealous that Claudio has the ear of his brother.
Oh, okay.
Instead of him. That's so he's jealous of Claudio. Anything he can do to screw Claudio is his end goal.
I mean, he clearly has like a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
I think at one point, you know, they refer to him being kind of like an out of wedlock child in this.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But it's all kind
noble of family.
The moment is like from right there. Early.
Yeah.
And it's not like a huge moment, but it's like you notice that he's putting things together in his head to kind of screw him over.
Yeah.
And you see like a lot where so much of our shtick in like comedies, and especially like romantic comedies, comes from here.
Mm-hmm.
Like all the, which I usually find it like very contrived in romantic comedies, where it's just like, just tell that person the simple thing, then that just, there's no drama. Like, that's about the only thing I'm not really crazy about the movie. But I mean, I get you need that to have all the situational comedy and,
well, I feel like this story does it well in the sense that those little contrary type things that are in our nowadays movies make more sense in this movie.
Well, because then they couldn't have spoke, like the two of them couldn't have been alone together to speak.
Right.
So it's like he couldn't have gone to her and been like, you know,
this is what I saw, or, you know, it wasn't me. They don't have that time to, like, I think the time period that this is set in and the way things were back then make it a little more believable that you can't just be like, please tell that person that.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it still just feels like it's, I mean, yeah, it's from the period, but it's very, like, it's not as stilted as I would, where that would make sense.
Right.
I think it works here better than it does in most places. I'm just saying, like, I usually find that very annoying, but it wasn't really that annoying here.
That's what I was saying. I think for me, it's because that time period, it just made it more believable.
Yeah.
Because I know what you're talking about, like in the modern movies, especially the romances, when there's something going on, it's like, why don't they just communicate?
Yeah, it's all just built on a ridiculous lie.
Right,
it's
exactly.
It's very easy to...
Splash.
But I mean, it's emotion, like it's here, it's at least steeped in an emotion, like Don John, his jealousy. It's like it comes from a real place, so at least it's emotionally, steeped in that.
That's true.
So it makes sense. So I can kind of go with it. I can ignore other stuff if it, like, makes sense for the character.
You get more of a sense here that, like, you know, marriage largely is about, you know, this time is about the contract and the ego and the not necessarily about, I mean, they just met and they're getting married, like, that week because that's how things worked.
Yeah.
And so, like, and then him agreeing to marry the niece to, like, save face with the family. I mean, it's not, you know, it ends up being her, but, like, the idea that, like, oh, the girl you were interested in just died. I have this niece instead that you can marry. It's not like it was not a weird thing to say because it's like you dishonored like the family. Now you need to still marry into the family to make it up to us. And that wouldn't have been a ridiculous thing to say at that time.
Which is wild.
Yes. I really love Denzel Washington has a little tiny moment with Beatrice where he's like, would you consider me? And she's like, nope. Like to the prince of the country. Just.
I think that's a
really
foolish,
sweet little
heartfelt. That's a foolish decision.
Yeah.
Moment.
He's Denzel. He's a prince. Nope.
Yeah.
I'd go for it.
He's very handsome and fashionable, but.
Yeah. But I mean, it just kind of shows like where her sensibilities are. I feel a lot of, I mean, obviously, like I think we've talked about Jane Austen before. Like there's a lot of this in Pride and Prejudice.
I do get like a Jane Austen, like Beatrice feels like a Jane Austen character in particular.
I mean, I'm sure she was.
Yeah, she would have. I mean, this would have been entertainment that they still like received at that time. Classics that they studied, and the idea like
been an inspiration.
Even the like the masquerade where they're talking about where she is talking about Benedict to Benedict, and he then doesn't know, and it's like
that was
gives the Lizzie under the stairs hearing like she's barely tolerable or whatever. You know, it's kind
of and like the whole matchmaking kind of thing they're doing as well, like Emma.
Yeah, just a little bit of. Yeah. I like it when you can see, like, traces of things through history.
Yeah.
And I think it's still, like you said, it's very watchable. It's very accessible. And I mean, I think it shows us that we have enjoyed, as a culture, stories like this for
thousands of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We enjoy it.
Well, and I just want to say, like, as a film, this one is, which we'll talk about Merchant of Venice, but I really... Like, as a film, this works.
It's
like, I feel like Brian Eich just generally gets Shakespeare. He's a Shakespeare dude. He gets how to adapt it. Because, you know, if you're on a stage, it's one thing.
Right.
But when you make a film, you either need to go... So if you're adapting a play on a film, you either need to go smaller. So something like The Whale, which only takes place in one room for the most part, one house. And it feels like you're in an entire landscape.
Right.
Or you need to go bigger. You need to expand the story. And I feel like this uses the estate. It uses all the locations, the garden, the house. It uses it really well, and it's photographed in it. And I think that's one reason it always moves is, like, the camera's always...
You're basically always seeing something.
Yeah, you're always moving to a new character, or you're moving to a new situation. Mm-hmm. It's always following them. It's not stationary and locked off.
Right.
And... I mean, Branagh, he does it in this one, but he does it even more. He did Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was his next movie. And that movie is, it's a fun movie, and De Niro plays the monster. Mm-hmm. But, like, there's so many, like, 360 Steadicam shots that are just whipping around people.
Oh, wow.
There's some of that. There's a few of those here. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, so he maybe took it a little far in that one. But just as a film, like, I feel like this one was much better than Merchant of Venice and much more cinematic. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, I did enjoy it a lot more.
Which I do like its use of place.
Yeah, and I mean, it really
like
only takes...
You see Don John in these kind of like dark, mm-hmm. you know, fiery
right.
rooms mm-hmm. where there really yeah. aren't a lot of interior scenes.
Yeah.
You know, like kind of closed off and, you know, it the spaces are chosen well for like the scenes where they happen.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And I mean, it all takes place at this estate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like there's enough variety there. It's a beautiful location. I would like to go visit.
Yeah.
I really love the couple, like, classic with the fool characters, the
yes.
Constables. Like, a couple, there are a couple, yes. like, very classic, like,
Michael
Shakespeare
Keaton.
Jokes.
Yeah.
In there where it's, like, they're fake riding horses.
Yeah.
Which feels very like a stage play. Or, like, where they hit the bar that the guys are balanced mm-hmm. on. Like, it's just some, like, you know, potty humor, yeah. like, that kind of stuff in there.
Yeah.
They're messing up their words, like, yeah. using words incorrectly and yeah. mistaking the meaning of the,
of, like, the word
higher
ass.
Up character.
He is, like, he's channeling Beetlejuice a little bit in a couple yes. moments. Like,
yeah.
when they're in the, yeah. when they're in the prison. Yeah. Is it the prison, the jail, or whatever?
Like, the jail, yeah. with,
jail
the,
with the
rector
the judge.
Or whatever. Yeah.
yeah. He's fun.
Michael Keaton's great.
He's always great.
Like when he came on, Josh is like, what's happening?
Yeah, he came on, they're like, I feel like I was in Monty Python for a second because they're like,
yeah.
make horses. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Who are these people? Why am I here? And I'm like, great, Michael Keaton, but it's like,
well, I
what?
Feel like in Shakespeare comedies, there's usually these kind of characters.
There's always
they're like the clown or the fool,
yeah.
and mm-hmm. they...
It's maybe out of place, but it's still very entertaining.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
And they do, like, he does, like,
kind of break
end,
it
up,
end up
being important
be
at the end, but...
silly,
yeah.
you know, to make the audience laugh.
Yeah. yeah.
Just kind of some, yeah, like, potty humor, like, he... Yeah. hits the thing near the guy's groin.
Yeah.
And...
Or he gets really excited
oh,
about
yeah,
being
like
called
that.
An ass, like... And then repeats it to everyone.
Yeah.
Why?
For no
who
reason.
Knows? For no reason. But he's really thrilled about this. I love that. Those would have been in the plays originally for, like, younger members of the audience or for the groundlings to, like, have something that's not, like, high drama
yeah.
to, like, laugh at. Because Shakespeare wrote for everyone, essentially.
Right.
So, like, I mean, you get it at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet. Like, the, like, I bite my thumb at you is, like... That whole scene's ridiculous if you've seen, like, uh-huh. you know, the stage play of it. Uh-huh. It's, you know, some bumbling fools, like. And so there's, like, a little bit of, I mean, in all the plays, there's someone who is, like, kind of the fool.
The bumbling fool, yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Keaton does a great job.
Yeah.
Very Beetlejuice.
That's
very,
true.
Very Beetlejuice-esque performance.
Yeah.
There's some manic moments that where I can just see him in, like, the suit and the kind of mm-hmm. decayed makeup.
Yeah. He has that crazy-eyed.
Yeah, yeah, the crazy
energy.
Eyes.
Yeah.
Which I think is what got him. Tim Burton was like, you'd be a good Batman. Crazy eyes. I want to mention Patrick Doyle's score.
Mm-hmm. That was beautiful.
The
yeah.
music is fantastic. And I was actually looking. So he's done pretty much everything Branagh has directed. He's mm-hmm. he's scored. He's not like as big a name as he should be, probably. But he did one of my favorites, which is Carlito's Way.
Mm.
I love the score to that movie. But yeah, he's done Hamlet, mm-hmm. Cinderella, Murder on the Orient Express, mm-hmm. Henry V. But like what that opening where they're riding in,
mm-hmm.
I was like, wow, that's some music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There he is playing full blast. And throughout the whole movie, I really liked, I just really enjoyed the score. I think it really added a little, it added, like it made it really, because I mean, it does largely just take place in one location, but it really opens up the movie and makes mm-hmm. it feel
yeah.
big when it needs to feel big and like yeah. funny and smart. Like it really accompanies the film very well.
The songs in the play were meant to be songs originally, but we've lost the music to like almost all of Shakespeare's like
songs.
Musical things. And so I think he did a really great job adapting like the Hey Nonny Nonny and
The song they sing in the garden.
The song at the garden yeah. and the song in the yeah, and the at the funeral. The
oh yes.
And it's like they feel very Elizabethan, but they like, but they still work in the context of this yeah. movie too.
And that's That's what I think about this movie overall, is just everything works. I mean, I'm not going to lie, going into it, I was not excited whatsoever to be watching Shakespeare movies. But this, I can say this is a movie I'm glad I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
It was good, and it's good to still have these kind of works that people can go back and at least acquaint themselves with Shakespeare in some kind of way. Yeah. I think this is a great one for that. The music is great. The shots are great. The storyline is great. And it's hilarious. I found it hilarious. That was my favorite part. It was funny.
Yeah.
And it's not a hard watch.
It's very charming.
Yeah, it is. Everybody's got their little charms about them. Characters are done great, which, I mean, all-star cast, like mm-hmm. we've already seen. I just think overall it was just, because I think I haven't seen very many Shakespeare movies, especially ones that are directly
done in the language, yeah.
Shakespeare. Not like, what were we talking about? 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, of course I've seen that. But this is more of an actual Shakespeare
movie. No, this is using the text.
Like an adaptation. Yeah. So I think this was a great starter into that, and I would recommend it for anybody that would be interested in starting to watch some Shakespeare. I just found it hilarious.
It's a good gateway film.
Exactly.
To get you into it.
It's not my favorite, but I think it's a great intro. I mean, I think if you give someone who's skeptical,
yeah, for sure,
you know, Macbeth or Hamlet, they're gonna be like,
"Oh, but there's." Macbeth is fun, though.
Macbeth is good.
It's probably my favorite one.
Macbeth?
Yeah.
That's true. Like, maybe Hamlet. Yeah. They can just be longer.
Right.
Darker.
Yeah, this one just, it flows
so
well.
It's kind of light and breezy, and you're like, okay, I can do this.
Well, I think, like, it just depends on what you're going to, like, I don't know. Macbeth has so many, like, dark, spooky tones that it becomes mm-hmm. fun in that way, even though it is, like, a dark play overall. But, like, I think this is a lot more approachable. And if you have trouble with Shakespeare, the Royal Shakespeare Company has, on their website, has the Shakespeare Learning Center. I think it's meant mostly for children. But it's a great way, like, they'll kind of go over all of the relationships between people and, like, they'll do breakdowns of the scenes and stuff. So if you're, like, kind of lost in the language, you can always...
It happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I had to pause it a couple of times and ask him to, like, what did they say?
What does that mean?
Yeah.
and it is easy. And that's what I was saying when I was having trouble watching it. It seemed like I was definitely having trouble with the language. But the good thing about that was the jokes still came across.
Yeah,
like,
they do.
I still laughed a lot.
They do in this. And I think just the flow, like, the interaction is so... I mean, sometimes they go, like, it just doesn't stop.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They just are flowing so well. Then I'm like, wait, what did they say? But I think it's just because they're so, the actors in this film are so, you know, they've probably done this several times.
Yeah.
They've probably done it on stage. So it just kind of comes naturally almost. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in the performances. It doesn't feel stilted.
It doesn't.
But it does, like, it flows so well that I have to stop for a second and just make sure I'm getting what I'm supposed to be getting.
Right.
But you can tell even from, I mean, even if you turned off the audio, I think you can generally understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Which I think is that's a hallmark of a good film, especially one that's so rich in dialogue that, you know, because they put Don John like in these dark, torturous chambers. So, you know, like, and you can tell by the way he's acting that he's conniving, he's scheming against mm-hmm. somebody. And you can, I think it works as a film, even if you took out the beautiful language.
It's so important with Shakespeare that you act what you're saying because of that.
Right.
Because, like, we don't speak Elizabethan English. Like, we don't know what we don't know what they're saying. Well, we had a conversation about the phrase maid the other night because of Aaron thought that she was saying she was going to be a maid after they were married.
I thought she was just, like, announcing her career. I was like, cool girl.
And I was like, Aaron, let's think about what the movie was about for a minute.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, man.
Because, like, using
really
things like maid instead of maiden or, like...
Right.
Yeah. Instead of being, like,
I thought she was like, and I'll be a maid. And I was like, that's weird to announce at your wedding, but cool. Like, thanks for letting us know what your plans are.
Well, it's just like there are bits where it's confusing because it is fast.
Oh, yeah. And I think that is part of it, too. Like you were saying, they've done it, and it flows so well that you kind of forget that you're listening to a different language sorts.
I mean, it's like music almost.
Yeah.
Like the language. It just is. I mean, part of it's almost like a rap.
Yeah. I mean, it literally kind of is. I mean, he would write.
And it flows and it has like a rhythm.
A lot of the dialogue is in, not all of it, but some of it's in like iambic pentameter, which is kind of a metered. Like your heartbeat. You know, it's very natural for our ears to listen. Musical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Writing on purpose.
Right.
Well, yay. I'm glad you didn't hate it.
Yeah, no. Like I said at the beginning, I just had a hard time getting into it. But I do that with all movies. And I think it was just a little bit extra with this because it was in, you know, a different language of sorts. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I mean, I still knew what was going on. And a lot of it probably was the acting like we were talking about. And a lot of the jokes still came across. I still laughed a lot. But overall, yeah, I thought it was a good movie.
I want to know what friar in Shakespeare's life recommended faking people's deaths on a regular occurrence. Because he uses that in a couple plays where he's like, the friar suggested faking your own death. And it's like, was this like a side hustle?
Works out here, not so well in Romeo and Juliet.
what?
Maybe it was just a thing.
Well, he's just like, I did it here and it was kind of fun and fanciful.
Now I'm really going to do it. Maybe, yeah.
This is just the warm-up.
I wonder which was written first.
I don't know,
because they don't know, it seems like every play has, a timeline of when it may have been written.
Yeah.
But it's not, a specific, this was written in 1891. Yeah, or not 1591, you know, or whatever.
This could have easily gone that way. Benedict could have killed Claudio in there, if they had actually dueled,
Or he could have freaked out and committed suicide, knowing that he'd caused the death of this young girl.
I mean, it feels like this is a warm-up to Romeo and Juliet in that way, you know. Someone's getting, there's a marriage between families, and there's could go to where someone is going to kill themselves or kill someone, you know, there's.
Yeah. Yeah. There's kind of that gravitas underneath it, but it's kept really light.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the big thing is pretty easy to, the big lie.
Yeah.
The big deceit is pretty easy to clear up, once everyone hears what happens.
It's also accessible because of so many of the Harry Potter stars, I guess, too, for modern audiences.
Yes.
I know she mentioned
that. You got two Defense of the Dark Arts teachers. They've got Kenneth Branagh played Gilderoy Lockhart.
Yep.
And then Imelda Staunton is Dolores Umbridge.
Yes. And Emma Thompson is...
And Emma Thompson is
Professor
also,
Trelawney.
Yes, Professor Trelawney.
Divination.
Yeah. And I think that might be it.
But those are pretty big characters in the Harry Potter movies.
Richard Briers looks very familiar for some reason. I can't think of what else.
He's an actor.
Well, no.
You're off the podcast.
Toby or me?
He did to me as well. I think he was on some Mr. Bean, which is where I've seen him.
Peter Pan also looks like as Mr. Smee.
Yeah.
I don't know. He just looked very familiar. But there's a lot of...
Yes, a very young, busty Dolores Umbridge.
Yes. Very. Yes. Yes.
And she was a maid.
She was a maid.
She was a maid.
Yeah.
Well... Yes. She was a servant. She was not a maid. In the context of...
Yeah. She was a handmaiden.
So the nudity upset you or cause any discomfort?
Yes.
In this one?
There was some...
Yes.
There's not a
female
lot.
Female butts and male butts?
I was
going to
say, no.
I mean, it's communal baths.
Yeah. It has a reason.
Yeah.
It has to make sense.
All the soldiers are coming in. Everybody got to get cleaned up.
Right.
Well, everyone's got to get all fresh for their...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that would be what they're doing.
Just messing with
it. Yeah. So I was okay with it.
It was so nice to see a young Emma Thompson. I don't think I've seen things where she was this age. And so it's oh.
This is pretty early in her film career.
Yeah.
I mean, she's I think she's probably 30 here.
She's not young.
She's
but...
not like young, young, but she's...
Yeah, she's probably about 30 or early 30s. Right? Mm-hmm. She's got to be in her 60s by now, I would think. Like early 60s.
If not older.
Not older, yeah. Older.
I would guess she's...
She was born in 59, and this was in 93. So she would... Wow, she would have been 44. 59 to 93.
Yeah.
No, she would have been 34.
34.
Yeah, yeah, so 34. Mid-30s.
I didn't put any input because today is not a day for me to math.
No, yeah, 34. So she's mid-30s here. And I think everything I've seen her in has been, She's incredibly talented. A baby.
Oh, she's great.
When this came out, it's really good.
I know her name. What else is she in?
She's in Love Actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Love Actually. She's Alan Rickman's wife.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. The cheating one?
The one who gets cheated on.
Yeah, the one
that gets cheated on. Alan Rickman cheats on her.
Yeah, that's what
she's
I mean.
She's got like short hair. She's the one that likes Joni Mitchell. Mm-hmm.
Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, like, her name sticks out big time to me.
Harry Potter.
Sense and Sensibility.
Oh, yeah, Sense and Sensibility, a Jane Austen.
I definitely haven't seen that.
Also with Alan Rickman.
Oh,
yeah.
Yep.
And Kate Winslet, another great one.
Yeah, I guess I've seen that. So, yeah, she's young in that,
okay.
too. She's
Saving Mr. Banks. Mm-hmm. Did you see that? She plays the author of Mary Poppins.
Yeah. That's a good movie.
I guess I didn't see that.
It's a good one.
I don't think. Oh,
surprisingly
no.
Surprisingly good. It's about Walt Disney, like, trying to get her, like, trying to get the rights to Mary Poppins, right? To
make making the movie.
And, like, trying to, like, he brings her to
Disneyland.
Disneyland to try to, like, convince her that they're going to do it right, and, you know.
Oh, okay.
It's really a lovely
movie. It's a good movie.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti's in it, too. I think he plays her driver. I've only seen it once.
I don't remember him.
Anyway.
She is Nanny McPhee. And those movies that were popular there for a bit with kids.
Well, anyway, Emma Thompson's awesome.
She's great.
Yeah.
And
clearly always very talented. Yeah.
Is familiar.
So I guess,
overall, I think we all like this movie. I don't think we had anything real bad to say about it.
No.
I think it's great.
Yeah, I do too. Awesome.
It was definitely the better of the two. But we'll get into that.
Yeah, we'll get into that.
Yes.
So I guess now we'll just go to some announcements and then we'll come back and talk about Merchant of Venice. Okay, so we're back from those announcements, and we're going to jump straight into The Merchant of Venice. So what made you choose that one?
The Merchant of Venice is one of my favorite plays. I also love the movie. I am of the impression that that love is not shared by all in this room. But I...
Not pointing fingers or anything.
Good news, this is real opposites.
Yes. I think naturally I gravitate more toward the darker element. Mm-hmm. I love Shakespeare, but my favorites are usually the tragedies. I think I love Merchant of Venice because to me it really is, it follows the literary structure of a comedy.
Right.
But I do not find it funny.
Right.
I find it extremely tragic and unsettling. And so I appreciate that kind of artistic maneuver, maybe have held out to his audience one thing and gave them something very different. And I think very remarkable for the time period in which he was living.
I imagine like kind of leaving the theater and being like, why? Like everyone ends up, okay, why don't I like this? Like kind of having that like unsettled, like kind of like, why am I not happy with the way that it ended? Even though it's like a happy ending.
It feels really kind of gross.
Yeah.
Right.
Like all the hero characters, even Portia included, who, you know, as a female lawyer, I find her very kind of badass.
Right.
You know, to like dress up like a dude and go into this court and save the day.
Yeah.
But the way in which she does it is really kind of
gross
at the end of the day and what they do to, I mean, you don't want. I just think it's brilliant. I mean, I think you don't want Shylock to kill Antonio. I think Antonio is...
It makes you feel for both.
You really do feel for both.
Yeah.
You see their really ugly sides and you see their really human sides.
Yeah.
And you see what we are capable of doing to one another. in this play.
That unfortunately still holds up.
Well, like you see people trapped in like kind of like what's it's more about like kind of what society has done to these men who otherwise are considered to be like upstand, like kind of like what these societal prejudices have done to people who are otherwise good people. And it's like it's interesting to see like how those things like wear at you until you do things that make you no longer human. And kind of it's a really neat I like this play also. The movie is okay compared to like the stage play, but I like the movie's not bad. It just I prefer this one on stage.
Like after when we finished watching the movie and hearing Kendall talk about the movie and like why she liked it and what it means to her and what she likes, you know, about it was much more gratifying and entertaining than the film itself.
Yeah.
To me. Like I want to see this on the stage. Mm-hmm. Like done properly, because I don't feel like the film does the story properly. Not that I've read that. I'm just saying based on what the kind of passion it invokes in you and you talking about what it, like what the characters mean and putting everything in context, that was more, I got more out of that than I did the film.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I feel like the film is just flat. Like what I was talking about with Much Ado, where it's like you either open it up or make it more insular. I feel like this is just kind of stays this middle ground. Everything is, you know, it's all like locked off and there's no really interesting blocking. There's no, like the camera work is not, there's no energy. It just feels lifeless. It feels like I might as well be watching just like a high school version of this, like a play. And it's just like they're standing there and then they're speaking and that's about it. And it's close-ups and mediums, just standard coverage. It's just boring as hell to watch. As great as Pacino is, as great as Jeremy Irons is, like both of them are just, you know, and Pacino at the end is definitely like, that's the high point of the movie for me, like his in the courtroom.
His performance is amazing.
He's amazing. And he really makes like that. I wish the movie had more of that. Mm-hmm. Like where I feel like there was really a fire there.
Yeah.
I wasn't feeling in the rest of the movie. And it's just like, you know, how Much Ado is very breezy and like it moves and it was kind of over before I knew it. This one felt like I could have watched the 4.5-hour Kenneth Branagh Hamlet in this time. It's just so monotone, the whole film. I didn't really feel anything until the end. But I want to see the play. I want to see a good production of this.
Right.
Because I think the story is really, because honestly, I feel like I would enjoy the story more than Much Ado. Mm-hmm. Just how you speak of it than what the film gave. I don't think the film does the story justice.
Yeah. And oddly enough, mark this down, I agree with Josh. I think the story itself is interesting, as gross as it is. I mean, in my opinion.
Yeah. Because we're supposed to find it gross.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that it's like pushing buttons.
Yeah. And I mean, I totally felt that, but I agree with you in the fact that it's too flat. It's like one dimensional. It's just, like you said, you either have to do it on a small scale or you just have to go big with it.
Yeah.
And Much Ado went big with it, and that worked perfect. This one...
It just needed opened up.
Yeah, it's all kind of dark, and it's kind of...
Gray.
Yeah, and I get what they were thinking with that. It's just that it makes it seem forever long, for one, which it is a little bit longer, but it's longer. Not tons longer.
Yeah. No, but it's way like, shorter than the play.
Right.
And I mean, it's like about 20, 25 minutes longer than.
Yeah, like, that's what I say. It's not, but it felt forever long. And like you said, it needed something bigger, I think. I think it was too many scenes where they were just in one spot for the whole time. And all the conversations were happening just in one spot. But I agree, the court at the end.
Yeah,
or towards the end,
it comes alive.
It really comes alive, and that passion comes through. And if some of the parts were like that, I think that would have helped as well.
I mean, the like lasting image of the movie for me is when they come to Shylock's office early on, and they're just like telling, you know, we're just going through kind of setting things up, like what they want from him, and it's just like kind of a medium wide, and everyone's just sitting and there's no movement. It's just people talking. And then when they do talk, it's just like close up, cut, cut, cut. When people are talking, it's just boring to watch.
Yeah.
And it's like when, like, even on a stage, like, people are getting up, they're moving around, like, there's blocking, like, you have marks, so you hit there, and then you say this line, then you move over here. So it's viscerally and visually, like, it's keeping me involved and engaged. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's just people sitting and talking, and it's just...
And in theater, you're, you know, quite literally in the same room.
Yeah, and right. I mean, it's a different energy, you know, and like, that can kind of work more, because at least you're there, you're watching them, and it's a personal relationship you're forming with the people on stage. There's stage acting and there's film acting, mm-hmm. and they're very different.
Yeah.
You have to project much more on stage, and you can, the subtleties are much, they work much better on film.
Right.
But you're going to get a close-up. You're going to get more, you know, the raise of an eyebrow or, you know, the utterance of, like, the cadence of a line. It's more, you can feel it more in a film, but you have to really work harder to make that, like, impact on the audience.
I can see that.
Yeah.
And I feel like some of the lines that were, because it is longer, like, if you were to see it on stage. Mm-hmm. But on stage, there will be times where his characters, especially villains, I think, will kind of talk directly to the audience, mm-hmm. like, kind of break that wall, and you're mm-hmm. kind of more, like...
pulled in. Mm-hmm. Where you're, like, part of it.
Yeah. Like, an aside.
Like, yeah, like an aside.
I could have done with that in this.
Because there's that scene.
Like something just more theatrical that's like, because I feel like, I'm sorry.
Oh, and I was just going to say, in that scene in the play, when they're kind of making this contract in his office, there is kind of an aside to the audience that's cut from the movie where he reveals that his intent really is, like, he would like to kill Antonio.
Oh, okay.
I feel like in the movie it's played a little bit more
ambiguous.
Understandably, like sympathetic toward Shylock.
Yeah.
That maybe, and I think the scene could be played the same way with or without that aside. I mean, clearly he's been treated terribly by Antonio for years. Yeah. You know, I would want him dead too.
Yeah.
But whether, you know, if he's really wants to be friends, I think that scene in the movie is played more sympathetically towards Shylock, that, you know, I would be friends with you. You know, you don't want this deal, you know.
Right.
I'm not really trying to to kill
you. Yeah, I got that vibe.
I'm doing this on a whim. And then in the movie, it really seems like, and I think in the play too, that when his daughter runs away, like, he's really becomes broken mm-hmm. by his daughter's betrayal and becomes like hell-bent on revenge.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the beginning, he, you know, you might like to see Antonio dead, but he's not.
Yeah.
So, but I think those asides that we don't get here, if you were in a room, you know, with Al Pacino and you felt like, oh, he's turning away and sharing with me his true thoughts, his innermost thoughts, kind of makes you a co-conspirator.
Well, I can already see that just working.
With him.
Right.
Like the movie just kind of stopping and he turns to the audience.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's just trying to play this as, like, kind of down, like, you know, quote unquote realistic, like down and dirty. It doesn't really work because the material itself is so kind of heavy and not like you said, like the structure of a comedy, but it feels a little bit more like a tragedy.
Yeah.
Like it's more heavy and dramatic.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
And I just think that you need to counterbalance that with something bigger, more theatrical. And I feel like something like that really would have really worked. Like I'd like to see Kenneth Branagh do this movie. Like just, you know, because it opens up and, like, you're moving through Venice and, like, I can't remember if it's one long shot, but there's a long, like, tracking shots just going through crowds and, like, you see the just people in the streets. And I'm like, okay, this is, but then it just kind of gets stuck in this gray-brown room after gray-brown room after gray-brown room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not interesting. As great as the subject is, it just, where the film lets it down.
Well, I think here, one of the things that's fun about Shakespeare in the case of the way that exactly that the asides kind of work is they let you into what a character is thinking.
Yeah.
And where you can, with a film, you can do that a little more with, like, you know, score and scene. And, like, it's really important in a play, especially like a Shakespeare play, that you know what is going on in someone's head. And I could, I think if they had given you a little bit, I get them not wanting to do that because it's not something that we do in movies now. quite so much. Like, you don't have a lot of asides to the audience or moments where someone is alone talking to themselves. Because you see it with Benedict, and Beatrice, like, in the gardens where they're like,
yeah,
you know, does he like all of their thoughts, they're saying them out loud. And I think that kind of helps bring you into the character there. So I'd
that usually would bug me, but it didn't bug me so much in Much Ado because
it doesn't when it's just because
they're so damn charismatic.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, fine, just go with it. Like, I'm,
I mean, it feels right in with Shakespeare. And I think like there's some level of keeping the play, keeping the feel of a play active in a movie is helpful if you're going to do it in the original language and the, like, you know.
Or either just completely change, like adapt it, but for, you know, change the language, change the tone, the setting.
Mm-hmm. Not try to play it so straight.
Not try to play it so straight, but I mean.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, like, I love this play. It's one of my favorites, and I fell in love with it on the page. Mm-hmm. And so I think just like any adaptation, especially one involving Al Pacino as Shylock. Like,
yeah. No.
I was going to love it.
Yeah.
But I hear, I hear all the critiques of it as well.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to separate like my love of the play from the actual film on its own.
I can speak on that. It's hard because even with movies that I pick, when you pick them apart and you pick them apart because of the way they're shot and stuff, it's so hard to separate that. But now I see that kind of stuff. And that was with this movie. It wasn't that the performances were bad. It wasn't that the story's not good. I enjoy the story as well. And I think the story is compelling. For me, it was just the way it was shot. Mm-hmm. And it just made me really feel like this was one of those movies you were forced to watch in school.
it does.
Like when your parents
like
wouldn't let you skip, but the teacher didn't really want to work either, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it really felt like that.
I showed it to my students.
Oh, no.
Because there's boobs in it, I had to get the approval of the school board.
Oh. So fun fact.
I achieved.
It's on the trivia about that. The bare-breasted prostitutes weren't put in the film to make it more risque, but rather to add a note of historical authenticity.
Oh, yeah.
Venetian law at the time required all prostitutes to bare their breast because Christian authorities were concerned about homosexuality in their city.
Mm-hmm.
So they were
there's
like,
"There's more boobs out than." I'm just like, "Hey, maybe I'm not gay."
Yeah, that's all it takes. By the way,
kind of like all it takes. Yeah, I mean, you know, that logic holds up.
That works.
So I love that it's historically accurate.
Yeah.
It's also thematically important.
Yeah,
because a big part of the movie is this flesh for money.
Like, right. Exactly.
Give me back. Get a pound of flesh, and prostitution is essentially selling your bodies, flesh for money.
And which, that is another thing that I was talking about, the nudity. It doesn't bother me because also historically, like, that's how it was.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, like, the visualization of the themes kind of stops there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, so I have some thoughts. I mean, I think it's an interesting choice, this, when we first kind of see Bassanio and Antonio, Jeremy Irons and, what's his name, Joseph Fiennes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who has the most punchable face?
He is so smarmy.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No offense to Joseph Fiennes. I just...
other little love interest, Lorenzo, though. I love Charlie Cox and, like, everything he's ever been in. He's so precious. Sweet.
Sweet. And he's, I think, maybe one of the more likable, you know, Christian noble characters of the play.
Yes.
Even though he has his issues, he's a little bit more likable than, I think, Bassanio or Graziano. Yeah. Graziano was like... played by another Love Actually actor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's probably why he looked familiar. Yes.
Chris Marshall.
Plays, Colin, God of Sex. In Love Actually.
Yeah, absolutely does.
But anyway, this scene where you're really kind of seeing Antonio and Bassanio interact for the first time in private, they put it in his bedroom. And they're, like, literally talking on his bed.
Yeah.
Because it's, I think, generally thought that Antonio kind of is a closeted homosexual and has feelings for him. And that's why he's doing all this for him, kind of as his patron.
Right.
And so I think that's maybe obvious without it, but kind of a visualization that There's this bed I see what you're saying. There, and in the way them and behind them, and have they ever?
Right.
I mean, I just, you know, I get
did
it.
Did Bassanio ever do favors in exchange for money? And now it's just money.
That makes sense.
I've seen that in the that was one thing is I thought they didn't quite. I mean, they kind of, like you said, they said it in a bedroom, but they don't quite go there as much as I've seen it. Like I've seen it in the play where they're very like when they're in a scene together, they're just like touch. Like they're always in like some kind of physical contact, and it's like very clear and more that they're like there's something going on.
Something going on between them, whether it's genuine or Bassanio playing to that because he wants Antonio's wealth.
Money, yeah.
I don't know. There's like there's just kind of like all sorts of levels of smarminess in this play, and I think that's part of what makes. I mean, I think Jeremy Irons' performance is great, and I think it's part of what makes Antonio's character more sympathetic, almost, is to kind of view him as this unhappy, closeted man who can't be accepted either in his as his true self, you know, in his society, although he's a Christian and a wealthy merchant, so he's has standing in the community, but he's
has to hide parts
Shylock's
of himself.
Foil maybe in that way that
right
his you know what makes him alien is more outwardly seen
othering in that like kind of way, and then like you know kind of like playing that with the power of like, well, if you're if you feel other, you feel like you have to go harder to be in, right?
Yeah.
So like the idea like maybe some of his mistreatment of Shylock comes from like having
makes him feel more
powerful and accepted, and that's like it's interesting.
It's an interesting
Well, it's just it's the play. Kendall's right. The play's phenomenal. A lot of it's not here.
Well, that's what I said. I mean, the story itself is compelling, and I think it, you know that it's not an issue with the story. Obviously, like Shakespeare was good at what he did, so I don't think it's that. I agree with Josh. Learned a little bit over the years, I guess, and. I think it's the shots for me that just make it harder for me to get into.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Like, in a film, you can, depending on your budget, of course, and everything, but you can kind of do anything. I feel like some films are limited by the imagination of the people behind the camera.
Right, exactly.
And I feel like not everyone was firing on all cylinders. I think Pacino and Irons were. I think the cast largely was. I think the filmmaking lets them down.
Yeah.
The people behind the camera, not in front of it.
Yeah, no, Pacino's, I mean, I was so excited to watch this because I know how much you love it and you've talked about it. And it's like, Pacino is like my second favorite actor of all time. I love Jeremy Irons too and everything.
I mean, I think they both knock it out of the park, like their performances.
Yeah, they're both great. Whenever they're on screen, that's why, I mean, I think that's why the courtroom scene at the end is the best part of the movie just because they're both there and it's just, dramatic.
It's a showdown.
I was just bummed that it's pretty early on. I was like, oh, this isn't really firing for me. But I still want to see a stage adaptation.
I can see it. I mean, someday. I love the... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to like nerd out momentarily.
Go ahead.
Do
we
it.
Like to nerd out on here.
But... You listened to my JFK thing in the last episode.
Yeah, it's true.
So in Shakespeare's England, there would have been like no actual Jewish people. They were kicked out of the country on pain of death to return in 1290. So like there wouldn't have been anyone.
Yeah.
Unless they were very, very closeted. There were a few people in the country who would have been converted Jews. And so I think in the culture, they became a scapegoat, kind of like a big bad wolf kind of character, like the easy villain. And for whatever reason, I mean, there's also, there's other lines where he is, you know, very anti-Semitic and in an uncomplicated way. One is in Much Ado, I think that's cut from the movie. But it's just kind of like, you know, what am I, a Jew? Meaning, you know, like, what am I, a villain? You know, it's just kind of very uncomplicated accepting of the societal norms. And I feel like for whatever reason in writing this play, he gets very deep into the humanity of his villain who happens to be Jewish.
And that's part of what I liked about this movie, because you do see that. And it, like you said, it wasn't exactly the norm to like deep dive into something like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's more nerding out I could do. There's postulations of what might have inspired this treatment. based on, you know, some current events and Elizabethan politics that Shakespeare may or may, was certainly aware of and may not have, you know, witnessed. You want to know?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm intrigued.
All right. So
yeah,
the queen,
like, please, your please words, give us so.
The
like,
queen,
history
Elizabeth. So this is like Queen Elizabeth times.
Yes.
Of like, you know, like the white-faced, you know, Cate Blanchett thing. And she had a physician who was Spanish, and the Spanish and the English were not on good terms at this point. And he was accused of taking money from the king of Spain to poison the queen. His name was Ruy López, and he was Jewish by birth and had converted to Protestantism. And so I think part of that thing, you know, whether or not he truly did conspire with, you know, the king of Spain to kill Elizabeth is kind of, I think, lost to the historical record. But there was a trial and he was convicted. And so he was sentenced to death. And at his, you know, final word moment, he, you know, was on the scaffold and said that he loved the queen as well as he loved Jesus Christ. And the spectators for this public execution just laughed. And so the thought is that this was meant to be his, you know, kind of moment of truth. I'm innocent, you know, I may have Jewish heritage, but I love Jesus and I love my queen and I would never harm her. The audience just like breaks out laughing and kind of denies him this moment of dignity before his death, taking it to mean, well, he's really a Jew and the Jews killed Jesus, so he really hates Jesus and really hates the queen, and so he's kind of slyly doing this double entendre.
I could see how it could be taken either way.
Equivocating.
Very easily.
Yeah.
And so Shakespeare certainly would have been aware of this high-profile plot, you know, to kill the queen and how it was, you know, by the grace of God brought to light and she was saved. This was a very religious culture. Obviously, church attendance was compulsory. But, I mean, he could have been there. He could have heard this laughter or heard about it and kind of felt, I don't know, maybe somewhat uncomfortable with the kind of general rules of his society.
Well, a lot of his plays do kind of push his like societal rules and norms. Like he has a lot of Moorish heroes. He has a lot of like, you know, people in his plays that were not the like standard of the time. Like the Othello would have been a little like, I mean, he talks about racial tensions in Othello, and he talks about like, because like Othello was a Moor, and that's poorly defined, but like it's poorly defined at the time, but like essentially someone of a darker complexion. And there's another play.
What are you talking about? Arnold Schwarzenegger played Othello.
Yeah, that's anyway. Moving onward from that, we're gonna ignore that.
Oh wait, no, that was Hamlet. Sorry, wrong Last Action Hero reference.
Anyway, moving on from that. Well, there's like even a, I can't remember what play it's in, but like basically the girl, he's like, the, you know, so, it might be Much Ado. I don't know. Where he's like, you know, someone of my complexion. And she's essentially like, I pray I never meet someone of your complexion to like marry or like, I can't remember what.
Oh, no, play. I remember that.
There is kind of a scene. Is it Much Ado or
is it? I'm
pretty
sure I remember that.
Because there's also in Merchant of
Venice. There's a Merchant of Venice, but she.
Where she's like, you know, if.
I thought she was like accepting of it.
She's kind of accepting of it, but she's kind of accepting of it in a roundabout way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you are as good as any suitor who's tried to come get me, knowing that I hate all my suitors. So I hate you too, but it has nothing to do with the color of your skin necessarily.
But yeah, but like just the idea that that is there is kind of like, you know, Shakespeare kind of touches on racial tensions a lot. So I don't think it's inherently surprising that he was feeling some kind of way about that.
It seems like he was, maybe feeling some kind of way. And he wrote this play kind of in the wake of that national thing.
I mean, he would have been.
It sounds like it's very plausible.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's important. Shylock kind of remains the villain of sorts, but like he is the one who is defeated come the end of the play.
But in a way that makes you feel so.
It makes you feel icky about it.
So icky.
And he cried and it made me a little sad.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is it's like he's skirting these, you know, he's heavily patronized by Elizabeth's court.
Yeah.
Like that's who pays him to make these plays. And so it's like the idea like, okay, like I want to talk about this, but I can't talk about it. so openly that they don't give me money anymore.
Or maybe, right. I don't know that we can ascribe him the morality that we feel watching. I mean, he may, he's definitely exploring it, what his personal feelings were.
Exactly.
It's hard to say.
It's hard to say. But I think it makes us uncomfortable, and I don't know. I feel like there's just something, it's hard to hear it with like Elizabethan ears.
Right.
You know, but when Graziano is like, tells Shylock to beg that he can have leave to go hang himself, like you just feel kind of like you've already ground this guy to dust. Like, why are you still hurling insults at him?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there was another popular play at the time by Christopher Marlowe called The Jew of Malta, where it involves like a murderous Jewish villain, kind of over the top evil villain.
Right.
And so this, in contrast to that, is much more, he's human.
Yeah.
Yeah, much more empathetic towards him.
Yeah.
In theory, Marlowe and Shakespeare had
a rivalry.
A rivalry, like a long ranging like rivalry the whole time.
I think old Bill won that one.
He won
Bill
Shakespeare.
Bill.
I mean, we don't generally talk about Marlowe's plays as much as we do Shakespeare's. I mean, I think there was some admiration there, probably some friendly rivalry. But, you know, this could also be viewed as kind of a response to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kind of easy villain, easy. This is not easy.
Oh, Willie Shakes.
Yep. Because they kind of beat him at his game, but it feels really yucky. Any thoughts about the whole ring thing? Like Nerissa and Portia give their husbands these rings and make them promise they'll never part with their rings.
Oh.
And then when they cross-dress as the lawyers, or lawyer's clerk and the lawyer, they ask for the rings as payment and are given these rings. And then there's that whole scene at the end where they get back to Belmont and they say that they've slept with the lawyer and the lawyer's clerk because they had their wedding rings. Because all this is kind of taking place in between their marriage and their consummation of the marriage. So they're kind of, it's all taking place in this kind of liminal space, if you will. But there's that whole scene about their rings. And I mean, even that feels gross to me. Like the love is like, oh, we love our wives so much, we'll never part with these rings. And like clearly the words are kind of empty because they're like,
oh, here's a lawyer.
Even though they're parting with their rings to their wives, like they don't know that. And their wives forgive them and the play ends with them going off to have sex.
Yeah.
And it just feels like gross.
Yeah.
To me. It's just kind of like nothing.
I mean, I feel like a lot of what was tradition then feels gross. I mean, even like we were talking about in Much Ado with them basically getting married off and it being just as easy to be like, well, here's my daughter. I feel like a lot of their traditions did.
Yeah.
It feels gross, especially when we watch it now.
Even above that, this just makes it feel like even more like, oh, these guys are just so, these are not the heroes. These are these smarmy, they'll do whatever is expedient in the moment.
Yeah.
Do they really love anything other than themselves and money?
No.
No.
Like, the answer's no.
Right.
I don't know. The moral of the Merchant of Venice is like, people suck.
Well, yeah. I mean, the idea.
I can agree with that one.
Yeah.
My life motto.
It's good to know they still sucked 400 years ago.
You're right.
Marriage in the Elizabethan era is just like, was contractual.
Not romantic.
Not romantic. Yeah. Like, if you had any like wealth, you had zero option to marry who you wanted to marry. Maybe your family was nice and you got a list of suitors, but probably not. You probably had, like, someone who was planned for you from birth. You know, contractual marriages work. I mean, statistically, people are just as happy in, like, arranged marriages as they are going out and finding a person.
Does that tell us about the institution of marriage?
I don't know.
Right.
Or human nature.
Yeah, it's just people are, you know, I think it also like has some, there's some cultural tendencies there depending on like if you're from a culture that's like uses arrangement, the idea that you work on something is a little more ingrained, or like the idea that maybe you don't need to really, like, you just have to make housework. You don't need to be
romantically
inclined,
yeah.
Which is sad to me. Like, I don't think I could live that life. But I mean, statistics.
Yeah, teach their own.
But, like, the idea of, like, you know, that time, just as easy. Like, marriages were about your family. They weren't about you and the person that you cared about. It just so happened that Claudio and Hero were attracted to each other.
Yeah.
So that helped.
And then, and I think kind of all our couples, Benedict and Beatrice are kind of the two that seem to have had the longest, even though it was
fawning.
Yeah.
Fighting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have each other. There's a fire there, no matter if
they have some sort of relationship and
there's been like a fawning of some sort.
Yeah.
They've known each other for a long time. And I think Beatrice even says at one point in the play when they were younger, he asked for her hand and she told him no. And so they've had this like years and years of like going back and forth. And
which
so
makes
like,
you kind of like them a little
better.
I mean, there is an arranged marriage in Merchant of Venice. Mm-hmm. Like her dad has from beyond the grave come up with this way to have her husband win her hand in which she has no say.
Right. Yeah.
Arguably with the caskets. Although it's funny, it's in the movie, but you don't really notice it as much. But the song that she has her little musicians play while he is picking, Bassanio is picking his casket, has a lot of words that rhyme with lead.
So the hilt, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
So it could be played as like, you know, she's trying to subtly drop hints to him
that he
should choose.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess there's maybe some moral leaning into which casket you choose to not be swayed by the shiny, glittery things, but still an arranged marriage.
Yeah, that's so true.
So being the Shakespeare nerd that you are, Kendall.
Yes.
What do you what is your favorite either on I mean that could be television too, like visual representation adaptation of Shakespeare? Is it Merchant of Venice?
No. My favorite visual adaptation of Shakespeare.
Well, I mean like a film or TV show or
TV.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, which is not overtly Shakespearean, would be the show Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that at its heart explores a lot of the same themes as a lot of Shakespeare's tragedies about the depths of evil to which we can fall.
Yeah.
Hubris.
But also still treating, as I think he almost always does, treating his characters with a lot of compassion. Like Walter White is a despicable human being by the end, but he's still kind of like the anti-hero in
right,
a way.
Exactly.
Like you're still kind
of. You still love him.
Yeah. You still love him. You're still kind of glad at the end that he, sorry, spoiler alert, tries to redeem himself. Like you're still kind of sad at how he goes out. And what he's lost, even though you know it's was his choice.
Yeah, it's definitely
to lose it.
And that shows
that
so
level
good.
Of a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like a modern meth world Shakespearean tragedy, and that's part of what I loved about the show.
I could see that. Yeah,
is it felt very like King Lear or Macbeth?
Yeah,
you know, minus the cool witches and supernatural aspect.
But what about like just a straight adaptation?
I have to admit, I've been kind of out of it for so long. There's a lot. I feel like I can't quite answer that question yet.
Okay.
I want to see the like Ron.
You haven't seen Shakespeare until it's performed in the original Japanese.
Well, you're talking about adaptations,
I know.
And I hear that they're
no,
quite
No, that was a
good.
Reference to Star Trek VI when Christopher Plummer, they have this big round table, and I can't remember who says it, but someone says, it's either Kirk or Spock says, like, to be or not to be, or maybe it's Christopher Plummer, and he's like, you haven't heard Shakespeare until you've heard it in the original Klingon.
Sorry, I missed the reference. But I've seen stage productions that have just like blown my mind of Othello and King Lear that I was very lucky to get to see.
Okay.
Less true like adaptation, but since Dune 2 is out, The King with Timothée Chalamet is a Shakespeare adaptation, and it's just phenomenal.
What's that an adaptation of?
It is of his like... Henry the Henry plays. It's parts of all the like the Henry the Fifth and Henry the Fourth kind of together. So they took pieces from all of those and put it out there. And it's a young Henry the Fifth doing. But it's Timothée Chalamet. I saw him do that and then got very excited about him playing Paul Atreides.
Cool.
He's very
good.
Which
he does a great job.
Yeah.
Aaron.
Yeah.
What?
This is your first Shakespeare adaptation? These two? That you've
seen
like in films?
Well, he's seen some things I hate about you.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
Seen I feel like.
You've probably seen like the 96 Romeo and Juliet.
Is that.
That's one with Leo yeah. and Claire Danes.
I feel like we watched that one day in school.
Mm-hmm. You probably did.
Probably did.
And.
I showed that to my students too.
Yeah. I don't remember it though, but I'm pretty sure we watched that, but I don't remember it.
Okay. Well, I showed them back to back scenes between that and the Zeffirelli.
Okay. Okay.
And they had to talk about how they were interpreted differently and which they liked better and why. So it wasn't completely devoid of educational merit.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would say. I think, like I said, The Merchant of Venice made me feel like a school movie. It's probably because any Shakespeare I've seen has been in school.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been like, let me watch that Shakespeare tonight. Like, I mean, it's never been something. I mean,
Alexa,
props to Shakespeare. What is it?
Alexa, Shakespeare.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I've seen some.
The it's Lion just not King is also
Hamlet.
It's Hamlet.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. See, and that's like my favorite Disney movie.
He's embedded pretty deeply in most decent drama.
That's what I say. I don't know that any of us can say we've never seen an adaptation of Shakespeare because it is heavily embedded in just
and
everything.
Shakespeare lifted a lot of his stories from other stories. Like the plot of Merchant of Venice was taken from an Italian story mostly. It's not original.
Yeah.
So it was Romeo and Juliet was taken from an aria that existed before. He just was really great at adapting things. And like his histories are really good too, which at the time would have been like, just like, here's what happened. Like, I love Julius Caesar. That's probably one of my favorites. Because it's
really
like
good.
Shakespeare's tellings of these histories are where we get a lot of what we know about the histories because the art has survived where the historical documents have not.
True.
So like.
Yeah, the historic record is a little bit thinner.
Yeah.
We're grateful these plays survived. Oh, the part that Shakespeare added to the story, which was otherwise mostly lifted. I'm not sure if the rings were in it or if he took the rings from something else and kind of transplanted them into the story. That whole like ring exchange debacle. But he added the kind of forced conversion of Shylock at the end.
At the end, yeah.
Which is really worse than a death in some ways for his character.
Yeah,
because
for sure.
He's now shunned by his own community. Yeah. He'll never be accepted by the Christian community.
Yeah, that's pretty
even
horrible.
Further othered than he already was.
Exactly.
But a very common punishment then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Compulsory conversion. So that was a little Shakespeare original to otherwise adapted storylines. Which, no, I mean, I think he adapts things masterfully.
Yay, Shakespeare.
Yay, Shakespeare.
I almost didn't say that, but yay, Shakespeare.
My favorite adaptations are Kurosawa's.
Oh, yeah.
Or what?
Ron. Kurosawa's Ron, which is King Lear.
Oh.
Which is perhaps my favorite Shakespeare play.
Oh,
so I'd
that
really
movie.
Like
we need
it.
To watch
King Lear's really good.
And Throne of Blood, which is a adaptation of
Macbeth.
That one is like, how do you bring a stage play to life? Both of those are just exemplary examples of Shakespeare's words and the cinematic power that Kurosawa wields. Those are amazing movies.
I like Throne of Blood. I've seen that one. I haven't seen Ron. That's a very strong adaptation of Macbeth.
Probably Macbeth's my favorite because Throne of Blood.
I mean, it is a great play. I don't know. I feel like sometimes the length and the heaviness and all that of some
of
the tragedies.
Throne of Blood's like 95 minutes, so.
It's an adaptation.
It's an adaptation.
That's
the
probably
play,
not bad.
The plays are long. Like, a lot of the play, I mean, Merchant of Venice is only about 3 hours, like 2:45 thing, or like Much Ado About Nothing is much longer in like performance than.
But I mean, Hamlet's long.
Yeah,
and if you're not like, if you're not really feeling it, like. Even if you love Hamlet, it can get a little bit tedious at times. So, like, I'd never be like, hey, want an introduction to Shakespeare? Like,
thank you.
Check
thank
out.
You not.
But, I mean, Hamlet's awesome. There's, like, ghosts and poisoning.
I think that's
and,
what I like, because I like the witches, right, in Macbeth.
That's Macbeth,
And I love, like, the one I wanted to pick from this podcast.
Sorry.
Titus, which is a long movie.
Yeah.
It was one of his early plays. Yeah. But it's about...
Cannibals.
I mean, it's got like all the family, like, you know, scheming and you know, it's pretty common. You know, there's familial drama and but you know, it's also got cannibalism and
fun
some
stuff.
Like, you know, rape and murder. Yeah. It's really
and it's Julie Taymor who is
she
has incredible artistic
she
vision.
Gets how to like bring it to life
oh, that's
like
good.
In a big
who did Across the
colorful adaptation.
Yeah, I loved Across the Universe.
Did you know that Forbidden Planet is
Tempest?
Yeah, the Tempest.
I'm noticing a theme here. I also showed my students Forbidden Planet when we did the Tempest.
Yeah, it's the Tempest.
I don't remember a robot getting drunk in the Tempest, though.
Yeah, it's Calvin.
Well, it's an adaptation. But I also dearly love the Tempest and enjoy doing that with my students. And tried to show them, you know, how all sorts of things can be adapted, including to sci-fi.
Yeah.
I mean, Shakespearean stories have, like, the roots in, like, Greek tragedy, so they've existed in that context for, like, you know.
Thousands of years. They came
from something that was 1,000 years older than when they, you know, and then moving on forward, we're...
Yeah. Yes, and like you said, Aaron, I think it's hard to be a person alive in the world today who reads books or watches movies who hasn't in some form seen
some level of...
I think even if you don't know, you have.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know Lion King was that, but I loved Lion King growing up.
Lion King is Hamlet, and Lion King 2 is Romeo and Juliet, but they don't die.
Well, I've never seen Lion King 2.
Probably, yes.
But I think it was more understood in those times. Like, if you're going to see a comedy, you're going to see marriages. If you're going to see a tragedy... Everyone dies.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, I mean, as much as I dreaded doing Shakespeare, I think it's been good to talk about him and talk about these, his works of art and how they do, you know, they're throughout our lives as of now. And like I said, Much Ado About Nothing was hilarious. And I think that was a good showing of how a play should be adapted.
Well, it's interesting to think about, like, that their concept of comedy and tragedy, and, like, now how those words have evolved. Like, tragedy still holds pretty much the same, but comedy now, like...
We think of it more of kind of like the Fool characters.
Yes.
Like Michael Caine, just bumbling. Like,
kind of.
Where just ha-ha funny.
It could have been, like, a drama. Like, we don't really, like, now I guess we could call, like...
Drama.
I think we would call, like, Merchant of Venice more of, like, a drama now rather than a comedy.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it just ended up being a good episode. Thank you for choosing the Shakespeare. It's been interesting to talk about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Kendall.
Yeah.
Shakespeare rules.
Now back to your regularly scheduled program. Next month, we're going to do a horror movie. Or next week. Next episode.
That wraps it up, I guess, as far as our Shakespeare episode. Like I said, thanks again to Kendall for joining us. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was fun. And
for the last time.
Things are getting kind of shaken up here at the library. Kendall, unfortunately, is leaving us to pursue law, which I know she'll be great at, but we also think she was great here. And I hate to lose you, but best wishes for future endeavors. And I'm sure we'll still see you around. So
you will.
Yeah. But it was good to have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
And like I said, the Shakespeare was interesting. I mean,
he had more fun than he thought he was going.
Exactly. That's what
that
I mean.
Makes me happy.
Like it ended up better than I thought it was going to be. But so with Kendall leaving, we also have Toby leaving Adult Services to transition back into Youth Services, where she originated.
She was born like an Uruk-hai from Lord of the Rings.
Right, the back room.
Emerged. That's the way you say emerged. Back to her original.
Back to her roots.
I didn't mean it like. I just meant like.
No, you're fine.
The way that I said it.
No, yeah.
She emerged from youth.
Yeah.
She emerged from youth.
So
hole in the wall.
So basically, Kendall is leaving, and Toby is going to be taking over that department. And with that, leaves the adult services open. So Josh is going to be transitioning into the Josh services.
The Josh services.
I'm getting into Josh. It's going to get weird.
So Josh will be transferring into adult services. So that does mean some changes for our podcast as well, as Toby will be leaving us as producer, and Josh will be taking over as producer. Mm-hmm. But Toby will be joining us as just a regular
host.
She will be a co-host.
So, and of course, I'll remain, you know, same old, same old.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that means Aaron's going to have to watch some anime.
Yeah. So I'm not excited about that. But it is, we're going to also rework our podcast formula a little bit. Most likely, we're going to, for most episodes, we're going to be doing one movie that one of us will choose. And maybe we'll even find some fun ways of choosing that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're going to play around with a couple different ideas. So it's going to be an exciting time at the library as well as with the podcast. I'm excited to only watch one movie per
I know it's like
episode. I don't even know what to do with myself.
Just I'll take the just thank me.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely not even my idea. It was Josh's. You know, content may be a little different, but not really. Good. So
It'll just be a little bit more.
It's just going to be structured a little
bit. Yeah, structured a little bit.
It might be a little shorter.
Yeah.
Because I don't see us talking about a single movie for
but then again,
an hour and 40 minutes.
It depends. Yeah. I mean, but
anyway. There'll be episodes where we'll probably have, we'll talk about two movies.
Yeah.
We have a guest on or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, we do have a couple things already lined out. Our next episode here is going to be April 1st, and it's going to be for April Fool's Day, of course. Yeah,
the original.
No, I mean like original. The holiday, April Fool's Day.
Well, yeah, for April Fool's.
And Josh has chosen
April Fool's Day.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if that was the actual. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's the name of the movie, April Fool's Day.
Oh, okay.
The original 80s slasher flick.
Okay, so it's
like 87, I think.
Yeah, 86. So that will 86. Be our first episode where we're just doing the one, but we're excited to go back to some horror, or at least I am.
Yeah.
I love
so,
horror.
So definitely join us then for all three of us in our new format. We also will have another special guest one in April, and we will be doing two movies for that one again. But before those, Toby and I will be at HerdCon on the Easter weekend.
March 30th, I think.
Yeah.
Yes. We don't know what day yet we're performing, though.
Yeah, we don't know what day yet. And I guess just keep up with our social media for that to be announced. But we will be discussing Tucker and Dale vs. Evil.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be discussing that with some people
from Marshall.
And they
will be cosplaying, so, you know, really come for
that
as well.
We will be cosplaying, right, Aaron? Oh, right? Right? You got those overalls on the way?
We'll see what happens.
Into a corner.
Here's what you do. You just come to HerdCon to find out whether I do it or not.
That's
a way to get people to come. Maybe they want to find out in person. Listen, one of our listeners, or the one listener, might want to.
Listen, they don't want to be disappointed when you're not in costume, though.
Yeah, well, disappointments happen in life. Sorry,
it's
guys.
It's a pretty costume, man. There's no mask.
I know.
Just some overalls and a blood splattered t-shirt. That's all we need from you.
But anyways, so things are changing. Things are afoot. And, I mean, it's going to be fun, I think.
Yeah.
All the changes. I'm excited about, other than Kendall leaving, I'm so not excited about that.
Yeah, I'm also not excited about that.
But other than that, I am excited about the changes that are coming up.
Y'all are going to do great.
I know.
I miss you a lot.
But you'll be around.
I will. So. I'll you know, stake out a little study table.
There you
in
go.
The adult section and study for the bar exam over there.
There we go.
The tutoring room is just booked for the next month. Just
basically. Sorry, everyone.
But I guess that brings us to the end of this episode. Like I said, we have things coming up. Keep a look on social media for more details, especially about the HerdCon. But until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Josh.
And this has been The Real Opposites.